even before President Trump announced his decision Tuesday to pull out of the historic Iran nuclear deal, global oil markets were already pulling back from 3.5-year highs. The return of U.S. sanctions, which could limit Iran's ability to sell oil, will ultimately lead to higher oil prices. There is concern among some traders that by pulling out of the multinational agreement, the unintended consequence could be a flare-up of geopolitical tensions in a region responsible for one-third of the world's oil supplies.
After four failed attempts, Japanese pharmaceutical firm Takeda has finally clinched a deal to buy out its rival Shire for $62 billion. It took 6 weeks to acquire the London-listed drug maker, and if it wins the backing of shareholders, it'll be the biggest deal yet in a wave of transactions sweeping the drugs industry. The final deal is around 46% cash and 54% stock, leaving Shire shareholders owning around half of the combined group.
Walmart's partnerships with Uber and Lyft to deliver online groceries are now coming to a screeching halt. For Walmart trying to compete with Amazon on groceries, it's a potential setback, although Walmart says it won't impact plans to scale grocery delivery as they aren't tied to a single delivery company. But for ride-hailing apps, it's also one less revenue line.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It is the 9th of May, and it's 5:11 in the morning. We're glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. Today on the broadcast, we're going to do a deep dive on China. In our first segment this morning, coming up momentarily, we're going to be talking to Elizabeth Economy about her new book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. We'll have that first for you this morning. Some news, too, about small businesses in Illinois, specifically restaurants and some old laws that might be hampering restaurant expansion. Elliot Richardson will be here. He's the founder and president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, oil prices are surging while Asian stock markets traded mixed after President Trump announced the U.S. would withdraw from the 2015 nuclear accord with Iran and reimpose sanctions. Resulting rising oil prices would have a mixed impact across the region, driving prices higher for some countries that rely heavily on imports like Japan, while boosting revenues for others, exporters like Indonesia. This morning on the markets, again, oil is trading higher, almost $2 higher this morning. $71.05 is the price of a barrel of gasoline. Dow futures up 141 points. NASDAQ futures up 27. S&P futures are up about 14. In Europe this morning, most markets are higher with the FTSE, the DAX, and the CAC all about a third higher. And in Asia, again, markets are mixed with the Nikkei going to end the day down about 99 points. About 0.5%. The Hang Seng up 133 points. The Shanghai is down about 2 points. A couple of stories that we're watching for you this morning. The Republicans in Congress, the GOP-led House, has voted to kill guidance from a consumer protection agency aimed at ensuring lenders don't charge minority consumers more on car loans. Republicans have made the rollback of government relations regulations a high priority. In this case, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau made a backdoor attempt to regulate how auto dealers negotiate loan terms with their customers, even though Congress explicitly exempted auto dealers from the agency's oversight. Also, NASA and Uber have signed an agreement to explore putting flying taxis in the skies over U.S. cities. NASA says it'll begin simulations for so-called urban air mobility vehicles that also include delivery drones. The announcement comes as the Uber Elevate Summit in Los Angeles brings together tech and transportation leaders to discuss the future of urban aviation. The book is called The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. And the author of the book is Elizabeth Economy. She's a senior fellow and director of Asian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's with us on the telephone this morning. Elizabeth, first, let's begin with why the title of this book. You talk about the Third Revolution, what's going on in China. Give us a sense of what that means and perhaps fill us in on some of the other revolutions, the two other revolutions in the past.
So the Third Revolution really marks the onset of Xi Jinping's vision for China. It builds upon the First Revolution, which was Mao Zedong and the creation of the party state way back in 1949. Then Deng Xiaoping's Second Revolution, he himself called it the Second Revolution, which was really this extended period of three decades where we watched China reform and open up both at home with a blossoming of civil society, the development of the beginnings of a market economy, welcoming influences from the West, but nonetheless having a very low-profile foreign policy. And now we have the Third Revolution, which in some ways upends Deng Xiaoping's Second Revolution because it really reflects a far more repressive and authoritarian China at home, one in which Xi Jinping is attempting to reassert the role of the Communist Party into the political system and into the economy, and at the same time a much more ambitious and expansive foreign policy. As Xi Jinping says, he wants to reclaim China's centrality on the global stage. This is all about the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation.
And so what we're seeing there develop is financial, military, global leadership, all of these things coming together.
That's right. I think when we look at the type of country that Xi Jinping is developing, this new China and the Third Revolution, it poses some very significant challenges for the United States on every front. So, for example, an effort to keep outside influences from coming in, the exact opposite of Deng Xiaoping, and we see this Made in China 2025 program, which is basically designed to ensure that by 2025, the Chinese companies will control, 80% of the domestic market in 10 cutting-edge technologies. This is one of the things that President Trump's administration is pushing back against right now in this this trade war. In the security front, we've seen Xi Jinping militarize these seven islands in the South China Sea, most recently placing missiles on some of the islands. These are contested islands and waters. Five other nations claim them as well. And in China also controlling now 76 ports in 35 countries. So there's a security element to Xi Jinping's ambition. And then finally, I'd point to a political element, and that is, China and under Xi Jinping, for the first time really claiming that it has an alternative model, an alternative to Western liberal democracy. And Chinese officials are now out in African countries like Namibia and Sudan and South Sudan and in Southeast Asia and even in Latin America, working with officials in those countries on how to promote political stability. In a way, Xi Jinping is trying to make the world safe for autocracy. So it, in many respects, it's a challenge that China now poses to the United States, to our values, to Western liberal democracies and markets across the board.
Some will say that there is a significant leadership vacuum that has developed globally because of America's first policies, Trump's America First policies. In your view, how significant is the problem caused by that?
I think it's certainly significant that President Trump's America First policy doesn't include a vision for American global leadership. They're not mutually exclusive. But if we look at just what's been going on in Asia, President Trump has had an almost exclusive focus on reducing the North Korean nuclear threat and reducing the bilateral trade deficit, both very important issues with regard to Asia and with regard to China. But at the same time, we need to think about the U.S. position more broadly in Asia. As we see China militarizing the South China Sea, as we see them taking control of all these ports in the Indian Ocean, where is the United States? We've withdrawn from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We have no role in economic leadership in the region, even as China is pressing forward with this grand-scale Belt and Road Initiative, you know, to connect China through the rest of Asia to the Middle East and Europe and Africa, we've basically taken ourselves out of the game in a significant way. So I do think it's important that the president begin to bring back not only a sense of strengthening the United States at home, but also assuring that our interests are protected over the long term abroad.
Should alarm bells be ringing by what you've just said? You know, from a military standpoint, it seems concerning. But this notion that we're not up there in the leadership as this global shakeout happens seems to be concerning.
It is concerning. Again, you can look at a number of different issues, from human rights to you know, how nations negotiate around the issue of internet sovereignty. You know, China has the idea that it wants to close off its internet, whereas the United States believes in the free flow of information. But as China's developing allies and working to secure its place globally as a leader, the United States is losing its voice. And so the steps that we're not taking now, the efforts that we're not putting in now to support our allies, to work with them on the full range of issues, these are going to cost us immeasurably over the next 10 to 20 to 50 years. And I'm afraid that's what's missing in the current administration's sort of global outlook. You know, it's fine to think about how we protect, you know, steel and coal workers, but we need to be also thinking about how we protect our technology industries and investing in AI and the technologies for the future, because that's what China's doing. So we risk taking ourselves out of the game for the long term.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you write about the importance of innovation in this third revolution, and it's happening in China at a faster pace than it's happening here.
Well, we still have the advantage of our companies, you know, being among the most innovative in the world. And I did interview a number of people in different ways involved in the innovation sector in China. And what they will say is that the United States is still the best place for basic research and for what you might consider to be invention as opposed to process innovation. But many more of them say, we're going to eat your lunch when it comes to things like artificial intelligence, right? They're collecting data at an extraordinary rate. They don't worry about things, as one person told me. They don't worry if there are a couple of accidents with driverless cars. They're just going to plow ahead, you know, unlike the United States, which will then start to put in many regulations around the development of new technologies. And they just have enormous investment from the central government. Their central government is basically, Beijing is willing to waste a lot of money, you know, incur enormous inefficiencies, but in the end, you know, they're going to end up with the largest electric car market and the largest, you know, electric car manufacturing center in the world, because they've spent 10 years developing this, refusing to be put off by all the waste and inefficiency. So in the end, you know, they're going to win.
How is this going over, not only in China, but in some of those places that you say that China is out spreading its wings in?
I think it varies. If you look at China's neighbors, for example, there's a lot of concern. So, again, this Belt and Road Initiative, which is this grand-scale plan for connectivity through both infrastructure but also, you know, digital infrastructure. So China wants to control GPS system and fiber optic cables and e-commerce, you know, throughout these 68 countries and beyond. If you look at the response of Japan and India and Australia, for example, there's enormous concern, and there's pushback. They're developing their own plans for, you know, development of their own kind of Belt and Road Initiative, you know, infrastructure efforts in Africa to compete with China. You know, we are largely absent from this initiative. There's the idea of a free and open Indo-Pacific, which would be the United States and India and Australia and Japan. Again, an effort to promote the sort of traditional democratic values and principles, as well as, you know, free trade and freedom of navigation. But there's not really any content to this initiative yet. So I think there's concern among many of China's neighbors. In many of the countries where China's investing, there have been protests because the people on the ground don't like the way that China does business, whether for environmental reasons or labor practices or just the fact that the bidding processes for many of the construction agreements for many of these large infrastructure projects are not done in a transparent manner. So there are a lot of issues surrounding the way that China does business, but nonetheless, you know, the deals get done. And the projects get built, and China is setting the technological and the infrastructure standards for the next half century. If you're building all the railroads, then those railroad gauges are Chinese standard. They're not going to be U.S. standard.
I remember when I was a younger man, people talking about China as the sleeping tiger. It sounds from your book that that tiger's awake and roaring.
Absolutely. In fact, Xi Jinping refers to China as Napoleon did, not as a tiger, but as a lion. And I quote Xi at one point where he says, you know, yes, the lion has awakened, but don't worry, it's a peaceful lion. So I don't know. To me, it seems more like the lion is on the hunt, and we need to wake up.
Yeah, and the peaceful lion makes you look again to the South China Sea, where there are many military analysts who predict that if there's some sort of shooting war that happens in the near future, that's probably where it's going to happen.
It's possible. I think there's the challenge in the South China Sea, certainly, and also I think over Taiwan. One of the issues that Xi Jinping has begun to raise with increasing frequency and intensity is the reunification of the motherland of China. And part of that is not just Hong Kong and Macau, but it's also Taiwan. And he's put a soft target of that of 2049. And the Trump administration has sort of bigfooted it into this issue in a number of ways. Now willing to license technology to Taiwan so that Taiwan can build its own attack submarines. We passed a new law that's going to promote senior visits between U.S. officials and Taiwanese officials. These are things that make the Chinese extremely unhappy. But I think that the United States has to be prepared, both politically and militarily, for China to undertake potentially some kind of action in Taiwan if it feels as though Taiwan is moving further away from the idea of reunification as opposed to closer together.
Elizabeth, congratulations on the book. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Economy is a senior fellow and director of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. The name of the book is The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. It's 5:31 here on the opening bell on 720 WGN.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's Inno Minute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Cameo is a new Chicago startup that lets you request and pay for video shout-out messages from celebrities. Via the startup's website and newly launched iPhone app, users can browse a list of celebrities ranging from Dennis Rodman to Lance Bass and request personalized video messages for themselves or loved ones. Messages range from $5 to $2,500. In a new partnership between Chicago tech giants Grubhub and Groupon, local diners are now able to order food off Grubhub through the Groupon app. The full ordering integration between the two platforms for users nationwide is expected to be finished over the course of the year, but those in Chicago can begin using it today. And Panera Bread announced it's launching an on-demand delivery service in Chicago and nearly 900 other cities. The food company is partnering with delivery logistics startup Ring, which is headquartered in Chicago and Tel Aviv, to roll out the new delivery platform. That's today's Inno Minute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. We're glad you're here with us on our Wednesday edition of the opening bell. We have had conversations on this program before about the difficulty new restaurants face, restaurants in general, really, face in getting off the ground and staying in business. What if we told you there was a 1934 law on the books that prohibits restaurants from opening, those that serve alcohol, within 100 feet of a religious institution, school, hospital, or military station? Well, there's an effort to change that in Illinois. And let's bring in Elliot Richardson this morning. Elliot is the founder and president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. Elliot, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much for having me to talk about this important issue.
Yeah, we saw your, you did a commentary in Cranes recently about this, and just sort of blew our minds that this law is still on the books. And not only that, the hoops people have to jump through to get an exemption from it.
It's unbelievable. You know, 1934, a law was passed that says you can't open up a restaurant within 100 feet of a religious institution or other institution that's spelled out in the bill. It's remarkably antiquated. It's outdated, Steve. And this law, this statewide law, really impacts businesses in at-risk communities and economically challenged areas that need economic development. And, you know, when you go to the south side and the west side of the city, if you go into other areas that are looking for vibrant downtowns, what happens is restaurants don't want to go in there because there's many churches up and down the street. There's nowhere to open up a restaurant where you're not abutting a church that may only be open on Sunday. So it keeps economic development out. And that is a shame. And that is one of the reasons why this law needs to be changed. Another reason is because if you actually do want to get an exemption, and only 75 have been granted in the 84 years this law has been on the books, you actually have to hire a lobbyist or find a way to draft legislation to give yourself an individual exemption, get it sponsored, get it passed out of the Illinois House and Senate, and signed by the governor. And that is not something a small business or a restaurant entrepreneur is going to be able to do.
So by my count, that would be like maybe one exemption, pretty much one exemption a year for the whole time that this law has been in place. It seems unreal. But there's an effort to change it now, and it's SB 2436.
That is right. That's right. And that bill passed unanimously out of the Senate. It's in the House right now. It's a critical time for this legislation. We need to get it assigned out of the Rules Committee to another committee, and then we need to get it passed out of the House, and we have about 2 weeks to do it. There, to me, seems no conceivable reason this bill should not move. It will empower businesses. It will create revenue, so it's revenue positive. It will create jobs. And it's that's why it's got bipartisan support, Steve. That's why it should move. And we are pulling out all the stops to make this thing happen right now in the General Assembly.
You say it's going to create jobs. Do you have any sense, Elliot, about how many of these restaurants or places of business might open up in these locations and how many jobs they might create?
You know, we don't have stats on how many jobs that might be created. What I can tell you is when you do talk to economic development activists down on the south and the west side of the city, if you talk to chambers of commerce executive directors in Lakeview, where a yoga studio could be counted as a religious institution, and you can't open up a restaurant there, what they tell you is that this is a really depressing economic development. So, you know, certainly, if you go down on the south side of Chicago and you see a street that has absolutely nothing on it, part of the reason is because restaurants don't want to come in there. So if you're able to bring in those restaurants and those restaurants bring in retail and you really start to work together to bring vibrancy to these neighborhoods, it's going to create jobs. And that's why it's such an important thing to move forward in the state this year.
I never realized that restaurants were economic engines to neighborhoods like this. I mean, I know that when one opens up, generally it's a positive thing, but you're telling me that they're actually economic engines.
I believe that they are. I mean, you know, that's where people travel to different areas to eat. And if there's a restaurant in a local neighborhood, you know, what happens next? Retail comes next to it. Again, there's so many desolate areas throughout the city of Chicago. This is something that can really help spur economic development in those areas, and that's what we hear from local leaders. This is a really important piece of legislation for local leaders throughout the city.
Well, and even outside of desolate areas, even in neighborhoods that, for whatever reason, growth has sort of stopped, this could be a boon for them as well.
Absolutely. Lakeview, Lincoln Park,
right.
And actually areas outside of the city of Chicago. And this is a really important point, Steve. All we're doing here is saying that you don't need a statewide prohibition that paints all communities with one brush. that says you can't open up a restaurant that serves alcohol within 100 feet of a church. It just brings it down to the local level. So if there's a community in Southern Illinois that says, listen, we've got our two churches, we don't want anybody serving booze within 100 feet of our two churches. Well, you know what they can do? They can do that on a local level. So it doesn't mandate that restaurants can serve alcohol within 100 feet of a church. It just simply gives local leaders the ability to make those decisions for their communities.
Yeah, I mean, they still have to go through the local liquor control commission and get their license just the way that any business would do anywhere, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Elliot, I have, you know, this kind of brought up the question, if this law is in place affecting restaurants like this, what other archaic laws are in place impacting small businesses like this? I mean, this is kind of what you do with this organization. I have to imagine that there are more than this.
Oh, there are so many. I mean, there's licensing requirements for things like barbershops. You know, we just changed ordinances in the city of Chicago that were having a really, really negative impact on home-based businesses. That's something we want to make sure that if people start a business at home and they do it safely and they do it in a constructive manner, that they're given the opportunity to succeed. We just lowered the highest LLC fees in the nation in Illinois because those fees were, I don't know if archaic is the word, they were just sort of ridiculous. That's the word that I would use. Right now we have legislation pending that would actually make government organizations take a look at the rules that they're passing and the way that those rules impact small businesses and give small businesses the opportunity to weigh in. And that is actually moving. That moved out of the Illinois House because you're 100% right, Steve. There are a lot of things hanging over small business owners' heads that really impact our businesses. And as smaller enterprises, we just don't have the time to navigate all of these different rules and regulations. So I'd love to talk to you about that at another time because there are so many things that we could change that can empower the small business owner in Illinois. And we're the folks who are driving the economy.
Elliot, good stuff here. We're going to stay tuned and watch the progression of this bill. We'll be interested to see what happens to it. And we can find out more about your organization, smallbusinessadvocacycouncil.org. And Elliot, we appreciate you being with us this morning.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much for having me.
Elliot Richardson with us this morning. Again, the smallbusinessadvocacycouncil.org online for more information.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures up 112 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are higher as well. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, yesterday in the grain market, we had a firmer trade in soybeans and corn. Again, weather worries in the forefront of that concern, but there was also some bargain buying. Soybeans firmed the day after the July contract fell to $10.10¾, which was a one-month low, but July corn bounced after dipping below the $4 mark for the first time in a week. So at the end of the trading day yesterday, we had July corn trading up 3 cents, July soybeans up 8¾, and July wheat up 4 cents for the day. But if you remember the song, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, well, there are now some more tears to be shed for Argentina. Soybean harvesting machines getting stuck in the mud as they try to move over waterlogged fields in Argentina. Again, another threat to the soybean crop hit hard by a drought that ended last month, but now giving way to near constant rainstorms that have turned once bone-dry fields into unharvestable mush. Well, you have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Wednesday, May 9th, in today's government reports, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for April, and the Commerce Department will release wholesale trade inventories for March. The Mortgage Bankers Association releases mortgage applications data today. We'll also see the EIA Petroleum Status Report due out couple of Fed speakers, Rafael Bostic among them. Also today, 21st Century Fox earnings. Tomorrow we get CPI, and then on Friday, the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey. Just some of the things that could move the markets.